The headlines: a massive crowd of Palestinians pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in a show of unity against Israel ahead of the International Quds Day. NATO Secretary General says Finland and Sweden are welcome to join the military alliance as soon as they ask for it, in remarks likely to anger Russia. And also, insecurity dominating U.S. housing market, with a new report suggesting massive public frustration with soaring home prices. Hello and welcome, everybody. We begin this hour with the developments in Palestine, where just a day ahead of the International Quds Day, tens of thousands of Palestinians have converged on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound for a congregational prayer. Palestinian media have put the number of participants at 250,000, who gathered in a show of unity amid recent Israeli desecrations of the holy site. Following the prayers, the worshippers chanted slogans against Israel and condemned the regime for its violent crackdowns at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The gathering was held despite Israeli warnings. Journalist and activist Jaffa Ramini says Palestinians have been and will remain united in their fight against the Israeli occupation.
There has always been and will always be unity amongst the Palestinian ranks, Muslims and Christians alike. This is a war for our very existence. The Israeli government, since 1948, every Israeli government, their goal and their ultimate aim is to occupy all of historical Palestine without any Palestinians in it. Jerusalem has been getting the brunt of their brutality exactly or in a way that the Gazans have been suffocated within the last breath of their lives. Palestine, Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Haram al-Sharif should not only be defended by the civilian Palestinians. It's a Muslim duty. And if anybody, any person, anywhere in the world, out of the 1.7 billion Muslims, the Muslim Ummah, call himself or herself a Muslim, they should come to the rescue of Jerusalem and their brothers and sisters in Palestine.
With the International Quds Day being around the corner, resistance groups have held a conference in the Lebanese capital to voice their solidarity with Palestinians. They called on Muslims to maintain their unity in supporting Al-Quds in the face of the Israeli aggression. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
Just ahead of International Quds Day, support for Palestinians is gaining momentum across Lebanon. The seminar was held in the Lebanese capital, where the speakers touched upon the significance of the Quds Day.
The significance of this holy day is that Imam Khomeini called on the free people of the world and the Muslims of the world and the Christians of the world to look at this historic, religious, and national enemy which wants to steal your sanctities and Judaize your city and bury your heritage. Be cautious on this threat and be united to face this aggressive enemy.
With the violent Israeli crackdown against the people of the Holy City in Palestine, activists say the sacrifices of the Palestinians will be fruitful, and that Al-Quds Day is an occasion for Muslims to stand united in supporting the Palestinian cause.
Imam Khomeini considered that our Arab and Islamic identity is incomplete without liberating Al-Quds. Therefore, this is a shame for those who continue to normalize ties with this enemy that continues to launch the most heinous assaults with their artillery and bullets. Thousands of wounded people have lost their eyesight, and many of them lost one eye or two. Hundreds of wounded people fell in the past assault. We will eventually pray in Al-Quds, no matter how long it takes.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General also stressed that Al-Quds is not merely a piece of land. It is rather an international humane cause. And Imam Khomeini established a cultural, ethical, and religious system to liberate it.
Imam Khomeini did not only make a declaration, he put a roadmap for the liberation of Palestine. He did not only call on the people to hold commemorations and events and make speeches to celebrate a day for Al-Quds, he directly closed the Israeli embassy and opened the Palestinian embassy. He founded Al-Quds Brigade as part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, which would begin to form the army of 20 million. This would extend to the rest of the region and would support resistance inside Palestine. The only objective is to liberate Palestine.
All the speakers at the conference agreed that those who believe in the Palestinian cause are convinced more than ever that Al-Quds in Palestine will be liberated. International Al-Quds Day has developed from being a day of solidarity and vocal support to being a day of practical coordination between the resistance factions. The Resistance Alliance has for once ratified a unified strategy of defense, and the focal point is Al-Quds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Earlier this month, a Palestinian man carried out a shooting attack in central Tel Aviv. Now, his family is facing the destruction of their home. Israeli soldiers stormed the Jenin refugee camp at dawn yesterday and delivered a demolition order against the house of Raad Hazem. His family has 1 week to file an appeal against the ruling. 28-year-old Hazem opened fire on a major street in Tel Aviv on April the 7th, killing 3 Israelis and wounding several others. Hours later, he was killed in a gunfight with Israeli forces. The regime forces have raided the camp to arrest Hazem's family members before, but have failed thanks to the resistance of its residents. Hamas and other Palestinian movements have hailed Hazem as a freedom fighter and branded the operation a heroic act. Maurice Gargour is a journalist and filmmaker and the director of A Talk with Remarkable People. In a documentary, she explores the geographical changes of the last century in the Middle East, particularly in Palestine. The documentary addresses the concepts of imperialism, colonialism, and Orientalism. We're now joined by Ms. Gargour to shed light on some of the most crucial issues relevant to Palestine. Ms. Gargour, welcome. A Talk with Remarkable People. The documentary explores the roots of the changes made in the region, including the occupation of Palestine. Can there be a solution to the Palestinian issue without taking historical context into account?
Well, this is a very difficult question. I don't think there will be something that is not taking in consideration all the history of Palestine, how it was before, and with the coming of the Zionists from Europe to Palestine. This is impossible for a Palestinian not to be accepted as injustice that was made to the nation of Palestine.
Of course, well, the oppression against the Palestinians, as we know, is not limited to the occupation itself, but a media propaganda in the West also exists against Palestinians. In your opinion, how has Western mainstream media framed the Palestinian cause for the public?
I could say that it's mostly silent. Yes. Dr. Noor Masalha has made a very good conference on the silences of the West concerning the whole history of Palestine in the West. So what we have is very limited. Anything that will go, will pass in Israel, that will be talked about, but in Palestine as a whole, Palestine for me is a whole. It means that historical Palestine before the Zionist occupation in 1948 and the 67 occupation of the land that is now the occupied territories. So There are two, I could say that there are two weights and measures, you know, on this very particular problem of the Palestinian history.
And Ms. Garwood, let's focus a little more on some contemporary developments. In your opinion, do you think that the normalization by some Arab governments with the Israeli regime could be exacerbating the situation for the Palestinians?
Oh, definitely, yes. Yes, of course. You know, when a problem is historical, this is what is happening is all factual. It's on the ground now. But to make the history of Palestine going and finding a solution, the only way to do it is to take in consideration the injustice that was made to the Palestinians. So whenever the Arab leaders of any countries are making more relations with Israel, it doesn't matter on the real ground of our history.
All right, thanks a lot. Director, producer, and documentary filmmaker Maurice Gargour joining us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Moving on, NATO Secretary General says Finland and Sweden will be able to join the Western military alliance quickly if they ask for membership.
We are in dialogue with Finland and Sweden, and it's their decision. But if they decide to apply, Finland and Sweden will be warmly welcomed and expect the process to go quickly.
Jens Stoltenberg has told reporters in Brussels that he's sure arrangements could be found for the interim period between an application by the two Scandinavian countries and the formal ratification in the parliaments of all 30 NATO members. Russia is strongly opposed to Finland and Sweden becoming NATO members and has threatened to deploy nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles in its Baltic enclave of Kaliningrad. If that happens, NATO's eastward expansion was one of the main reasons driving Russia towards launching an offensive against Ukraine 3 months ago. Russia could not be any clearer. Keep arming Ukraine and risk World War III. This is in response to the continued arming of Ukraine by the West. Russia's warning, however, is falling on deaf ears since the U.S. and its allies are adamant on providing Ukraine with more lethal weapons. Russia's other threat is also being ignored, the risk of a nuclear war.
The conflict in Ukraine has raised the prospects of an all-out confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachment and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia. And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Elsewhere, most home buyers in the United States are frustrated with soaring prices in the housing sector, which It's almost impossible for many Americans to own property. Official data show some prices rose nearly 19% in 2021. The figures also indicate that the median existing home price for all housing types in March 2022 was $375,000, up 15% from the same month last year. The problem has been compounded by a surge in borrowing rates. The interest charged on a 30-year fixed-rate loan has risen to over 5%, the highest level since 2010, compared to an average of almost 3% last year. Housing supplies were already tight when sales took off during the coronavirus pandemic, but builders have failed to keep up amid a shortage of workers and global supply chain problems, which have pushed housing prices higher. We've talked to Jack Rasmus, the professor of political economy at St. Mary's College of California. He believes the existing U.S. housing crisis will deteriorate.
The U.S. has not been building enough home units, housing units, for median and below people, mostly just high-end, mostly new housing. And the demand, of course, when you have such a short supply, it drives up the price even more. So it's a supply problem. It's also a demand problem. It's also the Federal Reserve's interest rates problem. And we already see in the last month or so a significant decline in new housing construction and purchases. And this is going to only get worse here going forward very, very shortly. It's already deteriorating. So inflation in housing is going to remain with us for some time and get worse. And the problem is the more that housing prices go up, the more that rents go up. That has an effect of dragging up rents, and far more people are renting. About 50 million people are renters in this country, or rental units, 50 million rental units, maybe 100 million people. So they are being squeezed even more, I would say, than new home buyers.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said, "Palestine is now the scene of humble bravery by an innocent generation and nation."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Pemmy. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochrane, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
He loves the game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist.
Controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win at all cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
He got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest liar, loser.
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed. Yeah.
I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me, Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all of the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe, you know, maybe he'd be a good one.
It just gave
me the chills. It's
and awful. What about you, Zach? What was your take on Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but has been involved in countless campaigns. But also, we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So.
Years in the making. Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure. And you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. Mm. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This is what was so useful about this film, was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment, and that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon, and we see this through the film when they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump. We see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build a wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which I had wider ramifications.
Yeah. Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that. That whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right-wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized, and it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. Mm-hmm. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way? And is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment has been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film, that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced. And so he's tapping into the majority of people the way that they feel, and mm-hmm. which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing, is his policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows, roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up, because we're about to go to him just now. So just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, when he denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades mm-hmm. and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that, where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. Mm. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
He knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them, is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. If we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But surely would discredit
part of this,
Trump.
He's part of this, and it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
that is a very interesting point. And Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stones where he said the NBCs, the CNN, actually, they're marginalised now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but of becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme centre. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far-right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's a, I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that, the work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is it merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going to win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. After talking about halal income and the dangers of not taking care about how we earn our money and how spiritually polluting an impure and illegitimate income would be, there are different kinds of ways of earning money and different types of methods of expenditures and ways of spending. And I think the one important thing for us to always remember that I'm going to be repeating frequently is to remember two important points that we can see that are frequently mentioned in our religion, Islam. Number one is balance. Number two is rida and being happy and content with what you have. Balance, as the Quran says, don't lock your fist, your hand as a fist tight to your neck. And don't be greedy. And don't open your hand all the way, which means don't be careless when it comes to, or reckless when it comes to money issues. Have balance. When it comes to content, when it comes to rida, be happy with what you have. Stop looking over the fence. Stop always comparing yourself to someone who is financially higher than you. In that case, you're always going to be eating yourself from with inside. You're always going to be miserable, you know. And then those other very evil kind of inside, batini, evil traits start to appear. The most dangerous of them is greed. The most dangerous of them is hasad and enviness. And of course that becomes, you know, the worst of worst when it comes to you as a human being.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih Al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli speaks about the different types of earning of an income and expenditures or ways of how we are able to have a livelihood. And I'm just going to be reading them very, very quickly so we can get a general understanding of what has been mentioned by Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Number one is farming and the merit and virtue of farming. We know that Ahlul Bayt salamullahi alayhi, especially Imam Ali alayhi salam, especially Imam Hassan salamullahi alayhi, they were very famous in their livelihood being based off of farming. And there are many adab, many etiquettes that are related to farming, what to farm, what not to farm, how to take care of your agriculture and cultivation and things like that, especially in the area of huquq, especially in the ad'iyah, the supplications that we are able to see from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that speak about fruit, that speak about cultivation, that speak about, you know, what you are able to say, what you should say at the time of planting and all these other things. Number two is cattle. And we know that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi and other anbiya were known as being shepherds. And they had an interest in that. And there are of course, explanations for that, that if they were able to master the act of being a shepherd or managing a group of a herd of sheep, for example, they would. That was a way of introducing them in how they are able to manage human beings and people. So it kind of like gives us that skill. And number three is business and transaction. Again, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, Sayyidah Khadija salamullahi alayha, in the area of tijara, in the area of business and buying and selling and things like that. There is one interesting hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, "Inna ma'ayish al-khalq khamsa." There are five ways of livelihood for creation. One of them is al-tijara. One of them is business, in business. And of course, there are also important issues, important fiqhi issues related to tijara that we need to know about if we are in this field. So if you are in the area of planting and farming and cultivation, you need to know the ahkam for that. If you are in the area, in the field of cattle, you need to know the ahkam for that. If you're in the field of business, then you need to know the ahkam for that. Here, we're not talking about the fiqhi rulings. Here, we're talking about the adab. What are the etiquette? What is the mannerism? What are the adab that need to be observed when it comes to tijara and business? Of course, for example, one of the things that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says when it comes to always remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, keeping Allah in front of you all the time, whenever you're involved in a business transaction, whenever you're buying something or selling something. Also have that honor of remembering that you need to do something with pride. For example, national pride. Purchase something that's locally made. Always try to support and endorse people in your network, in your community. Make sure that that becomes, you know, your concern. Be truthful, for example, is another mannerism that is important. Be simple. Never swear to God, "Oh, by wallahi, this is how much I bought it for. Wallahi, I'm going to lose." Stay away from that. You know, there are some people who say, "Will Quran this? Will Quran that?" No, that's something that should always be avoided and bad to do. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.